only a small remnant of the Jewish people remained in Judea. The fantasy of Jews as a brotherhood of evil was invented during this era when Christianity fought its missionary way to dominance. In the disorder of the Dark Ages, the Jews lost even their vestigial Roman citizenship. Those who sought protection won it from rulers like Charlemagne's son Louis the Pious, who knew their worth as merchants and craftsmen. But the price of protection was that they became the ruler's property. Their rights were thus no longer inherent, but chartered. Against that threatening insecurity, Jews could count their gain of judicial autonomy. Within their communities, they were allowed to administer their own laws. In parts of Spain, they had the power even of life and death. The medieval church, challenged by the spread of learning and the militancy of Islam to shore up its defenses against heresy, exercised its increasing power over the Jews balefully. The Lateran Councils of 1179 and 1215 made the baleful conflict visible by denying Jews authority over Christians, denying them Christian servants, relegating moneylending to Jews by forbidding it to Christians, forbidding Christians lodging in Jewish quarters, and thus officially sanctioning the establishment of ghettos, and most onerously, requiring every Jew to wear a distinguishing badge. Frequently, on local authority, the yellow Magen David that the Nazis later restored. Every Jew who ventured from the ghetto distinctively marked was a painted bird, exposed to attack. The fantasy of Jews as a brotherhood of evil swelled in medieval times to a full-blown demonology. The Jewish Messiah became the Antichrist. The Jews became sorcerers of Satan who poisoned wells, tortured the consecrated host, and murdered Christian children to collect their blood for diabolic rites. When the Black Death struck in the 14th century, a supposedly demonic people who poisoned wells were obvious suspects. They needed only to have infiltrated some more vicious poison into the water supply. A quarter of Europe died of plague. And in that time of horror, tens of thousands of Jews were burned, drowned, hanged, or buried alive in retaliation. Massacre became endemic. 350 Jewish communities were decimated in German lands alone. The English were the first to expel the Jews entirely. The Jews of England belonged to the crown, which had systematically extracted their wealth through a special exchequer to the Jews. By 1290, it had bled them dry. Edward I thereupon confiscated what little they had left and threw them out. They crossed to France, but expulsion from that country followed in 1392, from Spain at the demand of the Inquisition in 1492, from Portugal in 1497. Since Germany was a region of multiple sovereignties, German Jews could not be generally expelled. They had been fleeing eastward from bitter German persecution in any case since the 12th century. The Jews expelled from Western Europe fled to Poland, a large and thinly populated kingdom where elected monarchs welcomed them with generous charters. The medieval German of these immigrant Ashkenazim evolved into Yiddish. They founded villages and towns. They dispersed up and down the long eastern Polish frontier and lived in relative peace for 200 years. 25,000 at the end of the 15th century had increased at least tenfold by the middle of the 17th. Then, in violent wars with Russia and Sweden, Poland began to break up. Cossacks and their peasant allies murdered great numbers of Jews and sacked hundreds of their communities. The Ukraine was split in two. Poland lost the northern half to Russia. War and disorder continued into the 18th century with Prussia, Austria, and Turkey, variously, joining battle. When Russia invaded Poland in 1768, Prussia proposed a three-way partition with Austria to forestall a complete takeover. That led to Poland's partial dismemberment in 1772. In 1795, After another Russian invasion, the country was completely partitioned and ceased to exist. Much truncated, it was revived by the Congress of Vienna in 1814 as Congress Poland, joined to Russia by the linkage of Polish kingship for the Tsar. Its Jewish population had increased by then to more than 1 million souls. Prussia acquired about 150,000, but promptly expelled them eastward. Austria acquired about 250,000. Russia, which soon controlled more than three-fourths of what had been the Polish Commonwealth, then also controlled the fates of most of the Eastern Jews. But while Poland had welcomed them, Russia despised them. Its economy was too primitive to need their commercial skills, and it abhorred their religion. To Catherine the Great, her 1 million new subjects were first and foremost the enemies of Christ. The enemies of Christ became Russia's Jewish problem. In Russia's benighted intolerance, it framed only two solutions: assimilation by conversion to Christianity, or expulsion. For the interim, it practiced quarantine. A decree of 1791 limited Jewish residents to the formerly Polish territories and the unpopulated steppes above the Black Sea, a region that extended north across 286,000 square miles of Central Europe to the Baltic. The Pale of Settlement, pale in its old sense of enclosed by a boundary. The Ashkenazim numbered 1/9 of the Pale's total population, and might have prospered there, but they were burdened with further restrictions. They were heavily taxed. They could not live in the villages as they had done for generations. They could not keep the village inns or sell liquor to the peasants. Their traditional local governments, the Kahilot, were stripped of legal authority, but required to collect Jewish taxes. More horribly, under Nicholas I, after 1825, the Kahilot were charged to conscript 12-year-old Jewish children for a lifetime of forced service in the Russian army. 6 years of brutal education, followed by 25 years in the ranks, a fate that befell between 40,000 and 50,000 Jewish sons before the requirement was relaxed in 1856. The memory of that cruelty would endure. Edward Teller's grandmother responded to his childhood misbehavior, he reminisced, once with a friend, by warning him to be a good boy, or the Russians would get him. While Eastern Jews toiled to survive in Mother Russia, emancipation was proceeding in the West. Small Jewish communities had reestablished themselves, made up partly of nominal converts to Christianity who had escaped Spain and Portugal for Holland and England and America, partly of Eastern returnees. The Austrian Emperor Joseph II issued an Edict of Tolerance in 1782. The edicts of emperors were less important to the political future of the Jewish people than the temper of the Enlightenment, with its religious skepticism and its faith in the self-evident rights of man. The time had come in the evolution of European forms of government when no single group or class any longer had the power to dominate all others, as the nobility had previously done. The nation-state evolved in part to remove this impasse by investing power in the state itself. Such a mechanism made no distinction between Jew and Christian. American Jews thus became American citizens automatically with the Revolution and the Bill of Rights. The French, remembering ghettos and expulsions, found the emancipation of the Jews of France more difficult. The Jews should be denied everything as a nation, the Count of Clermont-Tonnerre argued in the French National Assembly, but granted everything as individuals. It is intolerable that they should become a separate political formation or class in the country. Every one of them must individually become a citizen. When a Jewish community contracted its loyalty to a monarch in exchange for his protection, it only did what other medieval classes and orders had done. But the nation-state was secular, and it considered the autonomous Jewish theocracies lodged within its borders in secular terms. In secular terms, a separate political body, theocratic or not, to which citizens gave their first loyalty, was potentially a rival and inherently subversive. Much monstrosity would devolve from that reification. In the meantime, liberty, equality, and fraternity prevailed, and the Jews of France became citoyens on a September Tuesday in 1791. Emancipations as they progressed within less revolutionary states included Holland-Belgium, 1795, Sweden, 1848, Denmark and Greece, 1849, England, by a gradual unmuddling completely in 1866, Austria, 1867, Spain, by the withdrawal of its 1492 order of expulsion in 1868, the new German Empire, 1871. Though they were influential out of all proportion to their numbers, the emancipated Jews of Western Europe, many of whom moved directly to assimilate, were only a minute fraction of the diaspora. The preponderance of the Jewish people increased by 1850 to 2.5 million, by 1900 to 5 million, struggled in increasing misery in the Pale. At his coronation in 1856, amid remissions and amnesties, Tsar Alexander II abolished the special conscription of Jewish children. Other alleviations followed, all designed to encourage Jewish assimilation. Useful Jews, wealthy merchants, university graduates, craftsmen, and medical assistants, were allowed residence in the interior of Russia, beyond the Pale. The universities were restored to autonomy and Jews allowed to attend. Within the Pale, Jews received limited civil rights and became eligible for local councils. But the Tsar, who freed 30 million peasants from serfdom, was dismayed to discover that reform, after so many centuries of repression, might lead not to expressions of gratitude, but to revolutionary agitation and revolt, as it did in Congress, Poland, in 1863, and the liberalization of Russian life stalled. Revolutionaries, a splinter group that called itself the People's Will, murdered Alexander on March 13, 1881, by lobbing a hail of small bombs into his open carriage in broad daylight on a main street of St. Petersburg as he drove home from reviewing the Imperial Guards. One member of the People's Will, not a bomber, was Jewish. That was pretext enough in the confused aftermath of regicide to blame the assassination on the Jews. A wave of pogroms. The curious Russian word refers to a violent riot by one group against another, began, that continued until 1884. Jewish disorders, the dogmatic new Tsar Alexander III called these murderous raids of drunken mobs on Jewish quarters everywhere in the Pale. They erupted with the active participation or tacit consent of the authorities. More than 200 Jewish communities were attacked. The first wave of pogroms, there would be more in later decades, left 20,000 Jews homeless and 100,000 ruined. Women were raped, families murdered. The government blamed the violence on anarchists and moved to expel even the useful Jews back into the ghettos of the Pale. With the pogroms came the 1882 May Laws, revising or repealing previous reforms and imposing catastrophic new restrictions. Between 1881 and 1900, more than 1 million Jews emigrated from Russia and Central Europe to the United States, and another 1.5 million between 1900 and 1920. A much smaller number of emigrants, like Chaim Weizmann, chose Western Europe and England. Most found less opportunity there than their American counterparts, and more virulent anti-Semitism. One of the important sources of German anti-Semitism in the years after the Great War was the strange forgery known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Adolf Hitler took the protocols as a text, to the extent that National Socialism had a text, for world domination. "I have read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion," Hitler told one of his loyalists, It simply appalled me, the stealthiness of the enemy and his ubiquity. I saw at once that we must copy it, in our own way, of course. Heinrich Himmler confirmed that connection. We owe the art of government to the Jews. To the protocols, he meant, which the Führer learned by heart. The protocols were Russian work. They link the Jewish experience in Russia to the Jewish experience in Germany, where so few Jews actually lived. Only about 500,000 in 1933, less than 1% of the German population. If Russia's hostility to the Jews was rooted in part in religious conflict, German anti-Semitism, by contrast, needed a secular myth. A half-educated apostate autodidact like Hitler especially needed some structure on which to hang his anti-Semitic pathology. German anti-Semitism had plentiful German antecedents. Richard Wagner's foamings were high on Hitler's list. But the protocols happened to arrive at the right time and place to earn a prominent position well forward. In the 1920s and 1930s, millions of copies of various translations and editions were sold throughout the world. The book is cast in the form of lectures and begins in mid-sentence, its scene unset, as if torn from the evil hands of its perpetrators. To supply the missing background, editors usually bound in explanatory material. A popular preliminary was a chapter from the novel Biarritz, the work of a minor German postal official, entitled In the Jewish Cemetery in Prague. Editors offered this lurid fiction, like the fiction of the protocols themselves, as fact. The historian Norman Cohn summarizes its setting. At 11 o'clock, the gates of the cemetery creak softly, and the rustling of long coats is heard as they touch against the stones and shrubbery. A vague white figure passes like a shadow through the cemetery until it reaches a certain tombstone. Here it kneels down, touches the tombstone 3 times with its forehead, and whispers a prayer. Another figure approaches. It is that of an old man, bent and limping. He coughs and sighs as he moves. The figure takes its place next to its predecessor, and it too kneels down and whispers a prayer. 13 times this procedure is repeated. When the 13th and last figure has taken its place, a clock strikes midnight. From the grave there comes a sharp, metallic sound. A blue flame appears and lights up the 13 kneeling figures. A hollow voice, the 13th figure, says, I greet you, heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. It is the devil speaking, and the figures dutifully reply, We greet you, son of the accursed. The protocols follow. They are 24 in all, some 80 pages in book form. What I am about to set forth, then, explains the speaker at the beginning of the first protocol, is our system from the 2 points of view, that of ourselves and that of the goyim. Much about the system set forth is incoherent, but the protocols elaborate 3 main themes. A bitter attack on liberalism, the political methods of the Jewish world conspiracy, and an outline of the world government the elders expect soon to install. The attack on liberalism would be comical if the protocols had not found such vicious youths. Liberalism produced constitutional states, and a constitution, as you well know, is nothing else but a school of discords, misunderstandings, quarrels, disagreements, fruitless party agitations, party whims. We replaced the ruler by a caricature of a government, by a president taken from the mob, from the midst of our puppet creatures, our slaves. A touching loyalty to the Russian Ancien Régime surfaces from time to time, and must have given European readers pause. The principal guarantee of stability of rule is to confirm the aureola of power, and this aureola is attained only by such a majestic inflexibility of might as shall carry on its face the emblems of inviolability from mystical causes, from the choice of God. Such was, until recent times, the Russian autocracy, the one and only serious foe we had in the world, without counting the papacy. In brief, the elders have stage-managed the invention and dissemination of modern ideas, of the modern world. Everything more recent than the Russian imperial system of czar, landed nobility, and serfs is part and parcel of their diabolical work, which helps explain how so obscure a study as physics came in Germany in the 1920s to be counted part of the Jewish conspiracy. The elders work to establish a world autocracy ruled by a leader who is a patriarchal paternal guardian. Liberalism will be rooted out, the masses led away from politics, censorship strict, freedom of the press abolished. A third of the population will be recruited for amateur spying. It will then be no disgrace to be a spy and informer, but a merit. And a vast secret police will keep order. All these were Nazi strategies, and certainly Hitler's debt to the protocols is evident in Mein Kampf and explicitly acknowledged. Russia's contribution to German anti-Semitism was plagiarized from a work of political satire, Dialogues from Hell between Montesquieu and Machiavelli, written by a French lawyer, Maurice Joly, and first published in Brussels in 1864. Montesquieu speaks for liberalism, Machiavelli for despotism. The concoction of the protocols was probably the work of the head of the Tsarist secret police outside Russia, a Paris-based agent named Pyotr Ivanovich Rachovsky. Borrowing and paraphrasing Machiavelli's speeches without even bothering to change their order and attributing them to a secret Jewish council, Rachovsky was attempting to discredit Russian liberalism by showing it to be a Jewish plot. A St. Petersburg newspaper serialized the earliest version of the protocols in 1903. It was one of three books belonging to the Tsarina Alexandra Fyodorovna, the other two were the Bible and War and Peace, found among her possessions at Ekaterinburg after the murder of the imperial family by communist revolutionaries on July 17, 1918. That coincidence returned the protocols west. Fyodor Winberg, who arranged the German translation and publication of the protocols in Berlin in 1920, was a colonel in the Imperial Guard. The Tsarina had been an honorary colonel of his regiment, and he had worshipped her. He escaped to Germany at the end of the Great War, convinced that her murderers had been Jews. Thereafter, revenge on the Jews was the central fixation of his life. He was a friend to Hitler's advisors, particularly the Nazi Party philosopher, Russian-born Alfred Rosenberg, who published a study of the protocols in 1923. The fiction of a Jewish world conspiracy had practical value for the Nazi Party. As it had done for earlier anti-Semitic parties, writes Hannah Arendt, who was on the scene as a student in Berlin in the 1920s, it gave them the advantage of a domestic program, and conditions were such that one had to enter the arena of social struggle in order to win political power. They could pretend to fight the Jews, exactly as the workers were fighting the bourgeoisie. Their advantage was that by attacking the Jews, who were believed to be the secret power behind governments, they could openly attack the state itself. The fiction also served for propaganda, to reassure the German people. If the Jews could dominate the world, then so could the Aryans. Arendt continues, "Thus the protocols presented world conquest as a practical possibility, implied that the whole affair was only a question of inspired or shrewd know-how, and that nobody stood in the way of a German victory over the entire world but a patently small people, the Jews, who ruled it without possessing instruments of violence. An easy opponent, therefore, once their secret was discovered and their method emulated on a larger scale." but the scurrilities of Mein Kampf, which, on the evidence of their incoherence, are not calculated manipulations but violent emotional outbursts, demonstrate that Hitler pathologically feared and hated the Jews. In black megalomania, he massed an intelligent, industrious, and much persecuted people with the distorted features of his own terror. And that would make all the difference. A German journalist had the temerity in 1931 to ask Adolf Hitler where he would find the brains to run the country if he took it over. Hitler snapped that he would be the brains, but went on contemptuously to enlist the help of the German class that still resisted voting the Nazis into power. "Do you think perhaps that, in the event of a successful revolution along the lines of my party, we would not inherit the brains in droves? Do you believe that the German middle class, this flower of the intelligentsia, would refuse to serve us and place their minds at our disposal? The German middle class would take its stand on the famed ground of the accomplished fact, we will do what we like with the middle class." "But what about the Jews?" the journalist persisted. "Those talented people, war heroes among them, Einstein among them." "Everything they have created has been stolen from us," Hitler charged. "Everything that they know will be used against us. They should just go and foment their unrest among other peoples. We do not need them." At noon on January 30th, 1933, Adolf Hitler, 43 years old, gleefully accepted appointment as Chancellor of Germany. With the Reichstag fire and the subsequent suspension of constitutional liberties, with the Enabling Act of March 23rd, by which the Reichstag voluntarily gave over its powers to the Hitler cabinet, the Nazis began to consolidate their control. They moved immediately to legalize anti-Semitism and abolish the civil rights of German Jews. Meeting at his country retreat in Bergstaden with Joseph Goebbels, now his propaganda minister, Hitler decided on a boycott of Jewish businesses as an opening sally. The national boycott began on Saturday, April 1st. Already during the previous week, Jewish judges and lawyers had been dismissed from practice in Prussia and Bavaria. Now, newspapers conveniently published business addresses, and teams of Nazi stormtroopers stationed themselves at storefronts to direct the mobs. Jews caught in the streets were beaten while the police looked on. The boycott was a nationwide German pogrom, and it lasted through a violent weekend. A month earlier, the evening after the Reichstag fire, Wolfgang Pauli had dropped in on a Göttingen group that included Edward Teller. The group had discussed Germany's political situation, and Pauli had declared emphatically that the idea of a German dictatorship was Quatsch, Pauli's favorite dismissal. Rubbish, mush, nonsense. "I have seen dictatorship in Russia," he told them. "In Germany, it just couldn't happen." In Hamburg, Otto Frisch had mustered similar optimism, as indeed had many Germans. "I didn't take Hitler at all seriously at first," Frisch told an interviewer later. "I had the feeling, well, chancellors come and chancellors go, and he will be no worse than the rest of them." Then things began to change. The Third Reich promulgated its first anti-Jewish ordinance on April 7th. The law for the restoration of the professional civil service, the harbinger of some 400 anti-Semitic laws and decrees the Nazis would issue, changed Teller's life, Pauli's, Frisch's, the lives of their colleagues decisively, forever. It announced bluntly that civil servants of non-Aryan descent must retire. A decree defining non-Aryan followed on April 11th. Anyone descended from non-Aryan, especially Jewish parents or grandparents. Universities were state institutions. Members of their faculties were therefore civil servants. The new law abruptly stripped a quarter of the physicists of Germany, including 11 who had earned or would earn Nobel Prizes, of their positions and their livelihood. It immediately affected some 1,600 scholars in all. Nor were academics dismissed by the Reich likely to find other work. To survive, they would have to emigrate. Some had already left, among them Einstein and the older Hungarians. Einstein read the signs correctly because he was Einstein and because he had borne the brunt of the attack since immediately after the war. The Hungarians had become connoisseurs by now of advancing fascism. Theodor von Karman departed first from Aachen. He had pioneered aeronautical physics, the California Institute of Technology, then vigorously assembling its future reputation, wanted to include that specialty in its curriculum. Aviation philanthropist Daniel Guggenheim was prevailed upon to contribute. The Guggenheim Aeronautical Laboratory, with a 10-foot wind tunnel, began operation under von Karman's direction in 1930. Caltech also courted Einstein, so did Oxford and Columbia. But he was attracted to the cosmological work of the dean of Caltech Graduate Studies, a Massachusetts-born physicist of Quaker background named Richard Chase Tolman. Ongoing observations at Mount Wilson Observatory above Pasadena might confirm the last of the three original predictions of the general theory of relativity, the gravitational redshifting of the light of high-density stars. Tolman sent a delegation to Berlin. Einstein agreed to visit Pasadena in 1931 as a research associate. He did twice, returning to Berlin between, dining in Southern California with Charlie Chaplin, viewing a rough cut of Sergei Eisenstein's death-obsessed film Qui Viva Mexico with its sponsor, Upton Sinclair. As his second visit approached in December, Einstein was ready to reassess his future. "I have decided today," he wrote in his diary, "that I shall essentially give up my Berlin position and shall be a bird of passage for the rest of my life." The bird of passage was not to nest in Pasadena. Abraham Flexner, the American educator, sought out Einstein at Caltech. Flexner was in the process of founding a new institution, not yet located or named. Chartered in 1930, with a $5 million endowment. The two men strolled for most of an hour up and down the halls of the club where Einstein was staying. They met again at Oxford in May, and once more at the Einstein's summer house at Kaputh outside Berlin in June. "We sat then on the veranda and talked until evening," Flexner recalled, "when Einstein invited me to stay to supper. After supper, we talked until almost 11. By that time, it was perfectly clear that Einstein and his wife were prepared to come to America. They walked together to the bus stop. "Ich bin Führer und Flamme dafür," Einstein told his guest as he put him on the bus. "I am fire and flame for it." The Institute for Advanced Study would be established in Princeton, New Jersey. Einstein was its first great acquisition. He had suggested a salary of $3,000 a year. His wife and Flexner negotiated a more respectable $15,000. It was what Caltech had been prepared to pay. But at Caltech, as in Zurich before, Einstein would have been expected to teach. At the Institute for Advanced Study, his only responsibility was thought. The Einsteins left Kaputh in December 1932. Scheduled to divide the coming year between Princeton and Berlin. Einstein knew better. "Turn around," he told his wife as they stepped off the porch of their house. "You will never see it again." She thought his pessimism foolish. In mid-March, the Nazi SA searched the empty house for hidden weapons. By then, Einstein had spoken out publicly against Hitler and was returning to Europe to prepare to move. He settled temporarily at a resort town on the Belgian coast, Le Coq-sur-Mer, with his wife, his two stepdaughters, his secretary, his assistant, and two Belgian guards. Assassination threatened again. In Berlin, his son-in-law arranged to have his furniture packed. The French obligingly transported his personal papers to Paris by diplomatic pouch. At the end of March 1933, the most original physicist of the 20th century once again renounced his German citizenship. Princeton University acquired John von Neumann and Eugene Wigner in 1930, in Wigner's puckish recollection, as a package deal. The university sought advice on improving its science from Paul Ehrenfest, who recommended to them not to invite a single person, but at least two, who already knew each other, who wouldn't feel suddenly put on an island where they have no intimate contact with anybody. Johnny's name was, of course, well known by that time the world over, so they decided to invite Johnny von Neumann. They looked. Who wrote articles with John von Neumann? They found Mr. Wigner. So they sent a telegram to me also. In fact, Wigner had already earned a high reputation in a recondite area of physics known as group theory, about which he published a book in 1931. He accepted the invitation to Princeton to look it over and perhaps look America over as well. There was no question in the mind of any person that the days of foreigners in Germany, particularly with Jewish ancestry, were numbered. It was so obvious that you didn't have to be perceptive. It was like, well, it will be colder in December. Yes, it will be. We know it well. Leo Szilard in Berlin debated his future in an amusing letter to Eugene Wigner, written on October 8, 1932. He was apparently still trying to organize his Bund. The knowledge had got into his blood that he had work to accomplish, at the moment, more noble than science, he wrote. Bad luck, it couldn't be distilled out again. He understood he wasn't allowed to complain if such work commanded no office space in the world. He was considering a professorship in experimental physics in India, since it would be essentially only a teaching post and he could therefore turn his creative energies elsewhere. Only the gods knew what might be available in Europe or on the American coast between Washington and Boston, places he might prefer, so he perforce might go to India. In any case, until he found a position, he would at least be free to do science without feeling guilty. Szilard promised to write Wigner again when he had an actual program. He did not yet know that his actual program would be organizing the desperate rescue. He parked his bags at the Harnack House in Dahlem and sat down with Lise Meitner to talk about doing nuclear physics at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. She had Hahn, and Hahn was superb, but he was a chemist. She could use a jack-of-all-trades like Szilard. But the collaboration was not to be. Events moved too quickly. Szilard took his train from Berlin, the train that proved him, if not more clever than most people, at least a day earlier. That was close to the 1st of April, 1933. If Pauli, safe behind the lines in Zurich, had misread events before, he was clear enough once the new law was announced. Walter Elsasser, among the first to leave, chose neutral Switzerland, and trained for Zurich, and homed on the physics building at the Polytechnic. On entering the main door of this building, one faces a broad and straight staircase leading directly to the second floor. Before I could take my first step on it, there appeared at the top of the stairs the moon face of Wolfgang Pauli, who shouted down, "Elsasser," he said, "you are the first to come up these stairs. I can see how in the months to come there will be many, many more to climb up here." The idea of a German dictatorship was no longer quatsch. Long-standing anti-Semitic discrimination in academic appointments weighted the civil service law dismissals in favor of the natural sciences, fields of study that had evolved more recently than the older disciplines of the liberal arts, that German scholarship had looked down upon as materialistic, and that had therefore proved less impenetrable to Jews. Medicine incurred 423 dismissals, physics 106, mathematics 60. In the physical and biological sciences other than medicine, an immediate total of 406 scientists. The University of Berlin and the University of Frankfurt each lost a third of its faculty. The promising young theoretical physicist Hans Bethe, then at Tübingen, first heard of his dismissal from one of his students, who wrote him to say he read of it in the papers and wondered what he should do. Bethe thought the question impertinent. It was he who had been dismissed, not the student, and asked for a copy of the news story. Hans Geiger was professor of experimental physics at Tübingen at the time, having moved there from Berlin. When Bethe joined the faculty as a theoretician in November 1932, Geiger explained his experiments to me and in other ways made a lot of me, so all seemed to be well on the personal level. Sensibly, then, Bethe wrote the vacationing Geiger for advice. He wrote back a completely cold letter, saying that with the changed situation it would be necessary to dispense with my further services. Period. There was no kind word, no regret, nothing. A few days later, the official notice arrived. Bethe, at 27, was sturdy, indefatigable, a skier and mountain climber, exceptionally self-confident in physics, if still socially diffident. His eyes were blue, his features Germanic, his thick, dark brown hair, cut short, stood up on his head like a brush. His custom of plowing through difficulties eventually won Bethe comparison with a battleship, except that this particularly equable vessel usually boomed with laughter. He had already published important work. Born in Strasbourg on July 2, 1906, Bethe moved during childhood to Kiel and then to Frankfurt, as his father, a university physiologist, achieved increasing academic success. He did not think of himself as a Jew. I was not Jewish. My mother was Jewish. And until Hitler came, that made no difference whatever. His father's background was Protestant and Prussian. His mother was the daughter of a Strasbourg professor of medicine. He counted two Jewish grandparents, more than enough to trigger the Tübingen dismissal. Bethe began university studies at Frankfurt in 1924. 2 years later, recognizing his gift for theoretical work, his advisor sent him to Arnold Sommerfeld in Munich. Sommerfeld had trained nearly a third of the full professors of theoretical physics in the German-speaking world. His protégés included Max von Laue, Wolfgang Pauli, and Werner Heisenberg. The American chemist Linus Pauling came to work with Sommerfeld while Bethe was there, as did the German Rudolf Pierls and American Edward U. Condon and I.I. Rabbi. Edward Teller arrived from Karlsruhe in 1928, but before the relationship between the two young men could develop into friendship, Teller was incapacitated in a streetcar accident, his right foot severed just above the ankle. By the time the amputation healed, Sommerfeld had gone off on a 60th birthday trip around the world, leaving Bethe, who had just passed his doctoral examinations, to look for a job on his own. Missing Sommerfeld, Teller chose to move on to Leipzig to study with Heisenberg. Bethe went to the Cavendish on a Rockefeller fellowship, then to Rome before accepting appointment at Tübingen. Since Geiger refused to help challenge his Tübingen dismissal, Bethe appealed to Munich. Sommerfeld immediately replied, "You are most welcome here. I will have your fellowship again for you. Just come back." After a time in Munich, Bethe was invited to Manchester, then to Copenhagen to work with Bohr. In the summer of 1934, Cornell University offered him an assistant professorship. One of his former students, now on the Ithaca physics faculty, had recommended him for the post. He accepted and shipped for America, arriving in early February 1935. Teller took his Ph.D. under Heisenberg at Leipzig in 1930, stayed on there for another year as a research associate, then shifted to Göttingen to work in its Institute for Physical Chemistry. His early papers, Eugene Wigner writes, were entirely in the spirit of the times, the expanding world of the applications of quantum mechanics. Teller probed the more developed part of physics, chemical and molecular physics, with vigorous originality, producing some 30 papers between 1930 and 1936, most of them written with collaborators because he was sloppy at calculation and impatient with the detailed effort of following through. "It was a foregone conclusion that I had to leave," Teller remembers. "After all, not only was I a Jew, I was not even a German citizen. I wanted to be a scientist. The possibility to remain a scientist in Germany and to have any chance of continuing to work had vanished with the coming of Hitler. I had to leave, as many others did, as soon as I could." The director of his institute, Arnold Eucken, an old German nationalist, confirmed Teller's conclusion as they left on the same southbound train for spring vacation in March 1933. "I really want you here," Teller remembers Eucken equivocating, "but With this new situation, there is no point in your staying. I would like to help you, but you have no future in Germany. The problem, then, was where to go. Back in Göttingen, after a tense confrontation with his parents in Budapest, they wanted him to stay in Hungary, Teller sat down to apply for a Rockefeller Fellowship to Copenhagen to work with Bohr. In Hamburg, Otto Frisch decided he would have to take Hitler seriously after all. Frisch, a personable young experimentalist with a gift for ingenious invention, worked for Otto Stern, the tubby Galician who apprenticed under Einstein and who had barked at Ernest Lawrence 4 years previously to get busy on his notion of a cyclotron. Stern was quite shocked, Frisch writes, to find that I was of Jewish origin, just as was he himself and another two of his four collaborators. He would have to leave, and the three of us as well. Although the University of Hamburg, with the traditions of a free Hansa city, was very reluctant to put the racial laws into effect, and I wasn't sacked until 7 months after the other universities had towed the line. Before the Nazis promulgated the civil service law, Frisch had applied for and won a Rockefeller Fellowship to work with Enrico Fermi in Rome. The program was designed to free promising young scientists from their immediate duties for a year of research abroad, after which they were expected to return to duty again. At a time of crisis, the foundation unfortunately chose to enforce its rules narrowly. Frisch was soon very disappointed, and at first rather disgusted, when the foundation told me that, the situation having changed because of the Hitler laws, they had to withdraw their offer of a grant, because I no longer had a job to come back to. In the meantime, Bohr turned up in Hamburg. He was traveling throughout Germany to determine who needed help. "To me, it was a great experience," Frisch writes, "to be suddenly confronted with Niels Bohr, an almost legendary name for me, and to see him smile at me like a kindly father. He took me by my waistcoat button and said, 'I hope you will come and work with us sometime. We like people who can carry out thought experiments.'" Frisch had recently verified the prediction of quantum theory that an atom recoils when it emits a photon, a movement previously considered too slight to measure. "That night I wrote home to my mother and told her not to worry. The good Lord himself had taken me by my waistcoat button and smiled at me. That was exactly how I felt." Stern, secure personally in independent wealth and international reputation, set out to find places for his people. "Stern said he would go traveling," continues Frisch, "and see if he could sell his Jewish collaborators, find places for them. And he said he would try to sell me to Madame Curie. So I said, 'Well, do what you can. I'll be very grateful for anything you can do. Just sell me to whoever wants to have me.' And when he came back from visiting laboratories abroad, he said that Madame Curie had not bought me, but Blackett had." Patrick Maynard Stuart Blackett, London-born, tall, a Navy man, with a lean, vigorous face, was one of Rutherford's protégés and a future laureate. He had just departed the Cavendish for a workingman's college in London, Birkbeck, after a furious argument over the extent of the Cavendish teaching load. "If physics laboratories have to be run dictatorially," Blackett had sworn, emerging white-faced from Rutherford's office, "I would rather be my own dictator." Birkbeck was a night school. Experimenters could work at peace all day, except when Blackett's automatic cloud chamber, triggered by a passing cosmic ray, went off like a cannon in their midst. It was temporary duty. Frisch took it. When the appointment ran out the following year, he crossed the North Sea to Copenhagen to work with the good Lord. He had the comfort of knowing that for the immediate future, his aunt was safe. Lise Meitner was forbidden, as of the following September, to lecture at the University of Berlin. But because her citizenship was Austrian rather than German, she was allowed to continue her work at the KWI. She had a subterfuge to confess, however. When Hahn, who had been lecturing on radiochemistry that spring at Cornell, returned hurriedly to salvage what he could from the wreckage of the Institute staff, Meitner sought him out. Her nephew explains, Liz Meitner had always kept quiet about her Jewish connection. She had never felt that she was in any way related to Jewish tradition. Although she was, racially speaking, a complete Jew, she had been baptized in her infancy and had never considered herself as anything but a Protestant who happened to have Jewish ancestors. And when all this anti-Semitic trouble began, she felt, perhaps partly to let sleeping dogs lie and partly not to embarrass her friends, that she would keep quiet about it. It was rather an embarrassment when Hitler forced it all out into the open, so to say, and she had to go and tell Han, "You know, I am really Jewish, and I am apt to be an embarrassment to you." At Göttingen, the Nobel laureate James Franck, a physical chemist, had a talk with Niels Bohr. Though Franck was Jewish, he was exempt from the civil service law because he had fought at the front in the Great War. He was no less outraged. The problem was deciding what to do. He listened to many people, but he told a friend long afterward that it was Bohr who persuaded him. Bohr insisted that individuals really were responsible for the political actions of their societies. Franck was the director of Göttingen's second physical institute. He resigned in protest on April 17th and made sure the newspapers knew. Max Born shared Franck's convictions and admired his courage, but disliked public confrontation. Placed on indefinite leave of absence as of April 25th, but hearing from the university curator that arrangements might eventually be made to reinstate him, Born responded brusquely that he wanted no special treatment. "We decided to leave Germany at once," he writes. The Borns had already rented an apartment in an Alpine Valley town for the summer. They slipped the possession date forward and went early. "Thus, we left for the South Tyrol at the beginning of May." He passed the news to Einstein via Leyden. "Ehrenfest sent me your letter," Einstein responded on May 30th from Oxford, which was courting him. "I am glad that you have resigned your positions, you and Franck. Thank God there is no risk involved for either of you. But my heart aches at the thought of the young ones." The young ones, the scientists and scholars just beginning to establish themselves, as yet unpublished, without international reputation, needed more than informal arrangements. They needed organized support. Leo Szilard's early train delivered him to Vienna, where he put up at the Regina Hotel. The news of the law for the restoration of the professional civil service reached him there, probably in the lobby, and he read the first list of dismissals. That outrage sent him into the street to walk. He encountered an old friend from Berlin, Jakob Marschak, an econometrician. Szilard insisted that they had to do something to help. Together, they went to see Gottfried Kuhnwald, the old hunchbacked Jewish advisor of the Christian Social Party, a Szilard admirer explains. Kuhnwald was a mysterious and shrewd man, very Austrian, with sideburns like Franz Josef. He agreed at once that there would be a great expulsion. He said that when it happened, the French would pray for the victims, the British would organize their rescue, and the Americans would pay for it. Kuhnwald sent the conspirators to a German economist then visiting Vienna. He advised them in turn that Sir William Beveridge, the director of the London School of Economics, was also visiting Vienna at that time, working on the history of prices, and was registered at the Regina. Szilard bearded the Englishman in his room and found he had not yet thought further than the modest charity of appointing one dismissed economist to the school. That response was at least three orders of magnitude too timid for Szilard's taste, and he prepared to assault Sir William with the truth. Kuhnwald, Beveridge, and Szilard met for tea, and Szilard read out the list of academic dismissals. Beveridge then agreed, Szilard's admirer writes, that as soon as he got back to England and got through the most important things on his agenda, he would try to form a committee to find places for the academic victims of Nazism. And he suggested that Szilard should come to London and occasionally prod him. If he prodded him long enough and frequently enough, he would probably be able to do something. The busy economist required very little prodding. Szilard followed him to London, and on a weekend at Cambridge in May, Beveridge convinced Ernest Rutherford to head an academic assistance council. The council announced itself on May 22nd proposing to provide a clearinghouse and center of information, and to seek to raise a fund. Among the distinguished academics who signed the announcement, besides Beveridge and Rutherford, were J.S. Haldane, Gilbert Murray, A.E. Houseman, J.J. Thompson, G.M. Trevelyan, and John Maynard Keynes. At about the same time, a similar response was building in the United States. John Dewey helped assemble a faculty fellowship fund at Columbia University. There were other immediate private initiatives, such as the hiring of Hans Bethe at Cornell. The major U.S. effort, the Emergency Committee in Aid of Displaced German Scholars, was organized under the auspices of the Institute for International Education. Szilard beat the bushes that summer. He did not feel he could properly represent the Academic Assistance Council, though he ran its office for the month of August as an unpaid volunteer. So he traveled and worked to coordinate existing groups and start new ones. A long and satisfactory interview early in May with Chaim Weizmann elicited support from English Jewry. Einstein had thought of creating a university for exiles. Szilard, working through Leon Rosenfeld, convinced him to devote his prestige to the common effort instead. In Switzerland, he nudged the International Students' Service and the Intellectual Cooperation section of the League of Nations. In Holland, he nudged a nervous and disorganized Ehrenfest, who had a small fund available to support visiting theoretical physicists. The university rectors in Belgium were sympathetic, Szilard reported back to Beveridge, but war reminiscences make it difficult to establish in Belgium any organization for the helping of German scientists. The Bohrs coordinated their own exhausting efforts with Szilard's. Bohr convened his usual summer conference in Copenhagen, but this time, writes Otto Frisch, he proposed to use it as a sort of labor exchange. Frisch found it a confusing affair with so many people and so little time to sort them out. It was Bohr with whom Edward Teller had hoped to work when he applied in Göttingen for a Rockefeller Fellowship. The foundation denied him an award on the same grounds it had removed Otto Frisch's, because he had no place of employment to return to. James Franck and Max Born interceded on Teller's behalf with the English, and shortly there arrived not one, but two offers of temporary appointments. Teller accepted an assistantship in physics at University College London. From there, at the beginning of 1934, with the Rockefeller to secure him, he shifted to Copenhagen. Szilard had help from an American, a Columbia University man, a physicist named Benjamin Leibowitz, who had invented a new kind of shirt collar and established himself in the business of shirt manufacturing. At 42, Leibowitz was 7 years older than Szilard. The two men had met when Szilard had visited the United States briefly in early 1932 and had renewed their acquaintance afterward in Berlin. Like Szilard, Leibowitz had taken up unpaid relief work. The two threw in together, the New Yorker supplying Szilard with a useful American connection. Leibowitz characterized the German situation vividly in a letter back to New York in early May. "It is impossible to describe the utter despair of all classes of Jews in Germany. The thoroughness with which they are being hounded out and stopped short in their careers is appalling. Unless help comes from the outside, there is no outlook for thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, except starvation or suicide. It is a gigantic, cold pogrom, and it is not only against Jews. Communists, of course, are included, but are not singled out racially. Social Democrats and liberals generally are now or are coming under the ban, especially if they protest in the least against the Nazi movement. Dr. Leo Szilard proved to be the best prognosticator. He was able to foresee events better than anybody else I know. Weeks before the storm broke, he began to formulate plans to provide some means of helping the scientists and scholars of Germany." Szilard was becoming nervous about his own lack of anchorage. He had not, he wrote another friend in August, dismissed the idea of going to India, neither has this idea grown stronger. He was not opposed to America, but he would very much prefer to live in England. Although he was rather tired, he felt very happy in England. His happiness darkened to a gloom as soon as he looked ahead. "It is quite probable that Germany will rearm, and I do not believe that this will be stopped by intervention of other powers within the next years. Therefore, it is likely to have in a few years two heavily armed antagonistic groups in Europe. And the consequence will be that we shall get war automatically, probably against the wish of either of the parties. That prepared him for that cool, humid, dull day in September, when he would step off the Southampton Row curb and begin to shape the things to come. Einstein crossed the Channel to England for the last time on September 9th and came under the flamboyant protection of a Naval Air Service commander, barrister, and MP named Oliver Stillingfleet Locker Lamson, who had the peculiar distinction of having been invited while serving under the Grand Duke Nicholas of Russia to murder Rasputin, an invitation which uncharacteristic discretion led him to decline. Locker Lamson sent the distinguished physicist off the next morning to a vacation house isolated on moorlands on the east coast of England. Einstein had left Belgium at his wife's insistence. She feared for his life. While she organized their emigration, he settled in at Rotten Heath, walking the moors, talking to the goats, he said. There he learned of the suicide of Paul Ehrenfest, one of his oldest and closest friends, on September 25th. Ehrenfest had tried to kill his youngest son and blinded him, and then killed himself. The largest public event of the rescue was a mass meeting in Royal Albert Hall, the great circular auditorium in London below Kensington Gardens. Einstein was the featured speaker, and therefore all the hall's 10,000 seats were filled and the aisles crowded. Ernest Rutherford came down from Cambridge to chair the event. Afterward, Einstein packed his bags and left for America, joining his wife on the Westernland when it stopped at Southampton on its way from Antwerp to New York on October 7th. The mass meeting had been meant to raise money. It raised very little. Cambridge physicist P.B. Moon remembers Rutherford's frustration. He did a very great deal for the refugees from Hitler's Germany, finding places for some of them in his laboratory and scraping together what money he could to keep them and their families going until they could find established posts. He told me that one of them had come to him and said he had discovered something or other. I stopped him short and said, "Plenty of people know that." "But you know, Moon, these chaps are living on the smell of an oil rag. They've got to push themselves forward." With the possible exception of French prayer, in fact, Gottfried Kunwald's shrewd prediction held true for the first 2 years of the rescue effort. The British alone nearly equaled the rest of the world in temporary appointments, and American contributions, largely from foundations like the Rockefeller, matched the rest dollar for dollar. Then, as the Depression began to ease and the English academic system pinched, emigration increased to the United States. Under official emergency committee auspices, 30 scientists and scholars arrived in 1933, 32 in 1934, only 15 in 1935, but 43 came in 1938, 97 in 1939, 59 in 1940, 50 in 1941. Nor were many of these physicists. With their international network of friendships and acquaintances, the physicists were better able than most to provide for each other. About 100 refugee physicists emigrated to the United States between 1933 and 1941. "Princeton," Einstein reported to his friend Elizabeth, the Queen of Belgium, "is a wonderful little spot, a quaint and ceremonious village of puny